Gabe texted us at 3 a.m. and told us to get out of bed and, you know.
Right. Get out.
Emergency. Emergency.
Literally, I was like, guys.
Alert. Alert. Guys. Alert.
Welcome to Rated Gen X. I'm Gabe.
I'm Curtis.
And I'm Aaron. And we're three Gen Xers talking about iconic 80s movies.
Yeah, this week we're doing something a little different, and we're breaking format. So instead of watching a film from the 80s and rating it, we're doing a bonus episode right now. It's almost like an emergency episode, but it's very timely, and it has to do with the fact that 80s icon and alleged Brat Packer Andrew McCarthy directed a documentary called Brats, which is now streaming on Hulu, and we really wanted to talk about this movie in particular. I can't tell you since we've started doing this, and I'm sure you guys have had this experience too. People are stopping me in the street, total strangers, saying, "Are you the guy?" But that said, everybody who knows we're doing this podcast has said, "Are you going to do the Bratz documentary? Right. You have to do the Bratz documentary. You've got to do this. Yeah, so we're morally responsible. We are breaking format. We're jumping in with this emergency bonus episode. This is
culturally responsible.
This is like the epitome of privileged white people problems, by the way.
Yeah, it really is. And you mentioned already it's streaming on Hulu. So are we getting any money for that?
Yeah, we're buzz marketing for
we're
them.
Helping them.
Yeah,
okay. Buzz marketing. Okay.
Cha-ching.
Before we jump in to the proper conversation about the movie itself, we wanted to tee off our teaser going into the break and have everybody come up with who either their favorite Brat Pack actor is, favorite Brat Pack movie, or just the key experience, sort of that transformative moment in our lives when we remember the Brat Pack making this impact on our lives.
So your favorite actor and your favorite, they don't have to go together. They can be separate, right?
Not necessarily.
To this.
Absolutely, right. Be separate, and it's up for debate. Honestly, who's in the Brat Pack? They talk about this in the doc as well, but I think
we'll get into that. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think there's actors who are not mentioned, like who are definitely part of this era and generation, and we can talk about sort of what defined the Brat Pack versus how did some actors escape.
Well, I can tell you my favorite actor. Are we going for this? Or are we going to a break?
Well, let's think about it for a minute. And
Okay. All right. I'm ready, though. Okay, fine. We can go to break. Okay. We'll be back after these words.
Hey there, Rated Gen Xers. It's me, Curtis. While you might be used to hearing me do a parody ad using some silly voice right around now, like for this episode, we were going to do something about a Wisconsin sausage company suing Andrew McCarthy for copyright infringement of the term Brat Pack. But instead, I'm so stoked about this bonus episode that I wanted to share our plans to create more bonus content just like this, exclusively for subscribers. Now, I gotta tell you, the Rated Gen X podcast is a true labor of love for the three of us. We've tackled it with the same DIY spirit that defined our Gen X punk rock ethos. You might notice that my mic sounds like it was used by Johnny Rotten. That's where you come in. If you subscribe, you can help us make Rated Gen X the best podcast ever. In the coming weeks, we'll be sharing more about how you can support us and get access to more cool bonus content like this, as well as exclusive features we'll be rolling out only for our subscribers. Don't worry, the regular feed will go on as it always has, but you won't want to miss out on all this special sauce. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the fun.
I love how we're always back. We're back.
We're back. From,
we disappeared, and now we're back. So before we talk about the Bratz film itself, we did want to jump in and talk a lot about the Brat Pack. So Aaron was literally on the other side of the abyss, all ready to jump in and say, who is the fave Brat Pack actor, movie, and or moment in your life that you said, yes,
it, I get it. It has to be Rob Lowe. I mean, it has to be Rob Lowe's my favorite. I mean, I think I already talked about this on an early episode about having the Rob Lowe poster. Yes, my poster with Rob Lowe with his tank top. And yeah. And
Gabe and I had the same one.
And you know it. And he continues to just be, you know, he had some disappointing things go on for a while, or some troubled times in Atlanta with the convention. I don't know if people remember that, but ended up on the West Wing, and then he ended up on Parks and loved him on Parks and Rec. I mean, he just continues to be, and loved him in this documentary as well. Yeah, I just love Rob Lowe. He's just,
Do you have a favorite movie that?
What movie?
It's not a Rob Lowe movie. He actually was really bad at it. And there's a lot of the movies.
But what Rob Lowe movie was it that made you love him, or was it just the poster?
I think it was just the poster.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, think so. Because I really never liked him that much in any of the actual movies.
Your favorite eye candy, Brat Packer.
I mean, he's just a beautiful man. Yeah, he's. As far as my favorite Brat Pack movie, I don't know. I mean, probably it would have to be Pretty in Pink, I would say. I mean, that's the one I've watched there's not a lot of movies I will watch on repeat, and I've probably seen that so many times. It's just it's a good movie. I've always liked that movie a lot. That's probably, and I don't know. Maybe I'll have more to say about that. And I'll interrupt you guys when you're in the middle of your talking about your choices with more to say on that.
No doubt.
Well, and Pretty in Pink is kind of the patron saint of our podcast, right?
Yeah.
Using their iconography in our
album art.
And
that's what
our
that
logo.
Is.
So we're leaning heavily into Pretty in Pink. So yeah. I totally get that.
Yeah. That Curtis. Was like, when we were trying to come up with an idea for how to do that. I was like, I know what we're going to do. We're going to do the Pretty in Pink poster, and we're going to do our faces on it. And that's
Aaron bumped her head in the toilet and had a vision.
You're Andrew McCarthy. Getting to be Ducky.
That kind of makes sense because Ducky's kind of the
and
real
we had a whole discussion
one.
About how whether we should use our real hair or their hair or you know we had
right
and I was like, well, like I paid good money for this hair, we're definitely going to keep this hair.
And I was
that
like,
is not an ad
if
for
you
Hair
put
Club for Men.
Molly Ringwald's hair on me. No, I don't think people are going to be able to tell the difference because our resting bitch face is exactly the same. People will just be like, well, yeah.
What is your
this is interesting.
Gen X
I think,
Bratz movie.
Because I think probably for me, well, first of all, I guess my favorite movie would have to be The Breakfast Club. And I'm going to kind of go with Judd Nelson for a few reasons, because my memory of going to see that movie, because I was such a goody two-shoes, you know, never did anything bad. And this kid that on my basketball team convinced me to skip school with him to go and try and go see The Breakfast Club. And we did the whole, like, pretend. It was rated R when it came out. And we did the whole, like, you know, because they didn't have PG-13 till Temple of Doom. It was the first PG-13 because it was like, you know, it had some swearing in it.
So good. Wow. Okay,
We snuck in and we asked this couple in front of us to pretend they were our parents or whatever to buy us tickets and shoo us into the movie. I couldn't believe I did that, you know, but it was very criminal, something that like Bender would have done.
You wanted it bad.
Yeah. So it's sort of like, and so. So, like, my favorite actor character in that movie, without getting too far gone in discussion of the movie, is sort of like he's the one that's really tearing down everyone's bullshit. Cut to, you know, moving to Hollywood and being a bartender, waiter, out-of-work actor in L.A. I actually spent a lot of time with Judd Nelson, and we'd hang out in the local dive bar and play video poker, et cetera, et cetera. So it was sort of like a full circle thing for me where I learned like how it felt good to be a criminal and then hung out with that dude. Apparently,
so if I'm getting this right, Breakfast Club is your favorite film and Judd is your favorite actor?
Yeah, because he's sort of the dark horse to the side guy and, you know, underdog kind of thing. You know, I've always got a big heart for the underdog kind of person, even though, you know, the characters he played, but I just kind of view him as a Brat Packer sort of, you know, especially, you know, as we'll get into, you know, he's sort of retreated, isolated, even though he's technically part of the pack, he's not. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, after watching the Bratz. I was like, dude, what's going on with Judd, man? You know, so anyway.
So for me, the movie, and it's interesting, y'all have both mentioned some of the key movies. Obviously, Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink are the key films that defined it for me. I was never a St. Elmo's Fire guy, even though that's the film that kind of defined the Andrew McCarthy experience. But to me, I brought up Outsiders because I remember when Outsiders came out and really thinking this, and we were really young when that came out, but really being impressed by just this quality group of young actors. And it really left an impression. And to me, that was the first gathering of what would become defined eventually as the Brat Pack. So that was predated the article. Yeah. So that's the one that I remember. We used to quote them. We'd always be like, do it for Johnny. Like we'd always like run around yelling that stuff. And we obviously Nature's First Green is Gold. Like those moments really left a mark on me. And again, as a young person, I wasn't going, oh yes, this is Francis Ford Coppola, who of course directed Apocalypse Now and The Godfather, and he's an amazing director. I was just like, this is a great movie for young people, and I loved it. So that was what really left that impression on me. There you go. Curtis is holding up a Stay Gold Pony Boy.
Wait, Gabe, do you know the story of how The Outsiders got made? Well, you know, The Outsiders is read very widely all over the country as part of the curriculum in 7th and 8th grade, middle school, et cetera. So there was a middle school in California, you know, I guess in the 80s, and they read the book and they wrote a letter and the kids all signed it to Francis Ford Coppola saying, we love this book and we think you should make a movie about it. And I think Francis Ford Coppola got the letter. He'd never heard of the book, read the book and said, yeah, let's make a movie about it. So because that's of cool. this middle school in California, that's how Coppola got, you know, interested in doing it, and the rest is history. So that's how I heard it.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so yeah, The Outsiders was the first. It just was the first movie that really made an impression. Obviously, very boy focused. Although, again, an actress who shines in that movie is Diane Lane. So I will throw her in as one of the really important figures of that time, who may or may not officially be in the Brat Pack. Probably not officially counted, but she's one of my favorite performers who came out of that movie. And then in Breakfast Club itself, and we've talked about this in the recent War Games episode, I think Ally Sheedy is just a revelation and a marvel. She's
we
brilliant
could have
in
seen that one coming a mile away.
And she's brilliant in obviously in The Breakfast Club, and she was great in War Games. Just hearing her talk about this era, we can transition straight into the doc now.
Somebody get Gabe an Ally Sheedy poster.
Hearing her perspective, looking back on that generation, though, looking back on her experience there, hers is closest, I would argue, to McCarthy insofar as like where the people in that block of actors and that group, where they ended up career-wise. Mm-hmm. She's closer to McCarthy than she is, say, to Demi Moore and Rob Lowe, who went on to have tremendous
sort
of big blockbuster success elsewhere. Some of these other actors did not have that breakthrough in the same way beyond the youthful pocket of films that we remember them for.
Right. But she seems to be completely comfortable with that, whereas he maybe not so much.
Yes. So
let's just rename this Andrew McCarthy's Midlife Crisis. Can we just really? Because
boo-hoo rich people.
I mean, it's, oh man, Andrew. And he was, Rob was always my favorite, but Andrew was definitely my second favorite. And I'm going, what did I see in this man? It was a rough one for me. It was rough watching this, guys. I don't know. I'll let you
Why
guys.
Why was it rough? Because it just like.
Because I wanted to smack Andrew McCarthy. Because I'm not, because I felt like. So, Gabe, do you want to just kind of discuss the premise of it? I'm jumping in. Do you want to kind of.
Yeah. I'll give you the top line review.
Give you the overview.
Here's what's interesting about this film. It's a documentary about the Brat Pack made by Andrew McCarthy, who is a member of the Brat Pack. And he wants to revisit his old Brat Pack friends and discuss the moniker of Brat Pack, how unfair it was to them, how it framed them he believes it framed them in a less than flattering light. It made them look like brats and B, didn't focus on their talent as actors and made them seem like flashes in the pan. Mm. And so he's looking back at that point in his life and he's like, I know what I want to do. I make a documentary about this. Those two things are interesting about the documentary. One is it's literally him shooting. He's hired a crew. So it's not just him shooting with his iPhone, calling people up, but he wants you to have that feeling that it is kind of this ragtag production, that he's thrown money at a couple, you know, cinematographers and stuff to run around and follow him doing these interviews. And the second thing that's worth noting is he's also written a book about this time in his life. So yeah, the documentary is the second part of it. So even as he's reaching out to people.
The book's been out a while, I think.
Yeah, the book's a couple years old. Yeah. But even as he's reaching out to the people and calling them up, he's acting like, hey, it's the first time I've talked to you in a long time. Like, he wrote this book a couple of years ago, too. So it made
But it's
me
clear
wonder.
They know it. So it's clear they know it's coming. Well, Emilio knew what was coming, that's for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And they knew how it was going to be, for sure. You know, Andrew McCarthy. Okay. It's all based on a New York Magazine article. And I've read the article and I just was kind of, I read it after the documentary and I was shocked at, I mean, he describes it as a scathing article at one point. This is Andrew McCarthy who describes it. It is not a scathing article. Pretty much focuses on this article as if it basically ruined his career. He sees it as like, you know, his career was not the career that it could have or should have been because of this article, because of this label. And this is what something he's had to carry for his entire life. And it's just like, dude, man. And he goes and he visits and everybody, Emilio Estevez, and he visits Demi Moore, and he visits Rob Lowe, and he wants them to commiserate, and the reactions, nobody's really kind of on board with him. It's very interesting. I don't know if you guys, I felt like the Emilio Estevez portion. How uncomfortable was that? I mean, how uncomfortable? They're in his kitchen. So like, go ahead.
Yeah.
You were
talking about it. Sort of like Andrew was like, this really sucked for me and ruined my career. But like, and he was hoping it did for everyone else too, but it didn't. Right.
Right. Right. It's like,
that kind of sucked, didn't it? But like,
right.
But everyone did their thing and worked around it. Like, what's your problem?
It's like, does it not occur to you that Rob Lowe was mentioned in that and did just fine?
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know,
well,
and
maybe your agent sucked too. I don't know.
Yes, you guys are hitting on sort of one of the major points. I agree, Aaron. If anybody wants to read the article, it is New York Magazine has republished it, so it's now available directly on their website. It's based on the 1985 article by David Blum, who is in the documentary, by the way. There are a few really key things that are worth noting on this. The first is, here's the headline. They're Rob, Emilio, Sean... Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Tom, Judd, and the rest, the young movie stars you can't quite keep straight.
Right.
Whose name sticks out in that list to you that I just said?
I mean,
let me read them again.
Not
for you,
Andrew.
Well, it tells you.
I mean, Andrew's... everybody on that list went like huge. Right. I mean, except
Andrew,
Emilio.
Andrew's not on that list. Number two of the names who are listed in the top five of this list. Tom Cruise and Sean Penn are in the original Brat Pack headline.
Yeah.
Right.
They're in the headline and they're not hung up on being so-called Brat Packers. I think that Emilio Estevez was the centerpiece of the article as well. And he was, if anybody felt maligned, he was the one who was most damaged by this article insofar as it derailing his aspirations to be seen as a serious actor like the rest of these guys.
What was that
and
moment
Andrew
where
McCarthy
he's at his house and he's
seems to
like
be holding him responsible? Like, how could you be so foolish to talk to this, think that this journalist was your friend and befriend him and let him in and ruin my life like this? And I mean, Emilio looked like he went to slap him
the president of the Brat Pack, you know, like it was like as if like this is, you know, Emilio was like the cornerstone of pulling everyone in together in this thing. Cut to the documentary and he's just like, yeah, that sucks.
Yeah,
you know, whatever.
I mean, and it, you know, it's really unfair the way he portrays it. And I really, you know, it's funny because and then he goes on to Demi Moore's house. I love seeing the interiors of everyone's homes, by the way. I mean, beautiful homes, but that was awesome. Amelia has some really nice cabinets. I don't know what kind of wood that is, but it was like, I mean, and Rob Lowe's house is gorgeous. But Demi Moore was so, how warm and sweet was she? Because she was like almost a therapist to him. She was like, this is what you're making it. This is about how you're viewing it. I mean, do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember this?
Yeah, absolutely. She's had the career. The ones who come across extremely well-balanced are clearly the people who've had this massive success beyond this window and who've processed that information. And so Demi Moore expresses all of the confidence of somebody who's spent a lot of time in therapy and processed mm-hmm. their demons. And she's completely comfortable with who she is. She comes across very well in the documentary and supportive. Like I love how supportive she is. I almost feel like the project of most of the people he was engaging with in the documentary was almost therapeutic. Like they're all trying to talk him down more than anything. Like it's Rob Lowe. The Emilio Estevez one is the, in my opinion, the partly the most contentious interview, but also it's the one where he says right out of the gate, I'm doing this because it's you, number one.
Right.
But if you notice the way the documentary is structured, he puts him first, which I think was a tactical McCarthy's part. And it might have been the first interview he did. I'm not sure. But the way he builds most of the interviews, they're staged like 60 minutes interviews. He's got cameras set up. They've got the people sitting down. Mm-hmm. With Emilio, you got the sense that he did closer to the way 60 Minutes used to do those storm people coming out of their office interviews. Like it feels like he sneak attacked him because he was not set up to sit down. He has the camera crew right there. I think he's like, Emilio, I'm going to come over. I want to talk about this documentary I'm making. Emilio's like, yeah, sure, come on over. And then he's like, what the fuck are these cameras doing here? He stood up the entire time. He did not sit for the interview.
Oh, I know. They're on opposite sides of the kitchen island. Last time I broke up with someone in my kitchen, it was the exact positioning. Like him on one side of the kitchen island, me on the other. Like, all right, this is how it's going to go. No, it was not last night. But that's how it felt. It felt so, it was.
But
it
wait
was
a minute. Like, you know, as much as it was like the whole like Andrew like you know running around like this I think this messed me up and all that, but like didn't Emilio said like because of that you were kryptonite and like he didn't want to work with anybody else in that article because it would just you know drive their career down, like he was talking about that script that he wanted to do with Andrew McCarthy, but because of that he didn't want to do it, you know, that he was already, you know, the gears were turning.
So here's the question about
how to get out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
right. But here's the question about that, Curtis. Like, again, I'm going to go back and read some names that are featured prominently in the headline of the article.
Right. Sure.
Sean, Tom, right? Those two guys clearly had tremendous careers.
Right.
I think it has as much to do with, and this is where Emilio and Andrew are telling themselves that their career was sidetracked because of this article.
Right.
Whereas there's a million reasons why careers fail. There's a million reasons why careers accelerate. It's a huge deal of luck, a huge deal of talent. It has to do with timing and being in the right moment, the right time, and the right films and so forth. And I do think that in McCarthy's case, he admits he was brooding at the time. He didn't embrace the moment. He was so against being in the Brat Pack at the time that I don't think he enjoyed it. And I believe his lack of enthusiasm at that time is probably what hampered his ability to advance his career. And I'm not saying
they literally show clips of him interviewed during that time. And do you remember his whole demeanor? And he's like,
Emilio.
Yeah, just the sad sack about it.
Yeah, Emilio and McCarthy, both of them. Yeah. They were the two who seemed to take it the hardest, and Judd Nelson.
And Rob's like, why has it got to be a bad thing? Why? Right. Why has it got to, you know, flip
the
script,
whole
man?
Thing. I'm like, there's no such thing as bad press. And I would argue that this article ultimately helped everyone.
I'd be willing to bet that for the majority of people who watch this documentary, it is going to be news to them that phrase Brat Pack came from a article that was a negative, supposedly, piece of press. And it was, they're going to be like, oh, what? But it was like, you know, like a cool club to be in kind of how I think a lot of people see it. And they don't even realize it was something negative until.
I agree. I think, and the ones who embraced it, right? their ability to not be affected by it, right? Their ability to lean into the opportunity is really what helped their career. What's interesting is in the doc, you'll notice there's this great moment with John Cryer, who I would also argue is one of the he's one of the most important figures of that time, but he technically is not part of the Brat Pack.
Right.
Right.
But there's a really interesting reason why, and this is not 100% original idea. It's inspired by an article that was written by Tom Skoka, a brilliant writer for he wrote this article called "How Much Can One Headline Weigh," which we'll put a link in the show notes.
Okay.
And Tom, not unlike you and me, I actually went to elementary school with Tom, so we go way back. So it's funny for me. I'm like having this conversation with two of my high school friends. I'm dropping references. I'm name dropping left and right here because that's what you do.
That's my job.
We're the bratty brat pack.
Bratty.
But he points out that if you look back at Pretty in Pink, a movie we talked about earlier, in the original version of the film, in the original cut, Molly Ringwald ends up with Ducky. Right. She ends up with John Cryer, and they changed it because nobody wanted to. Right, they didn't want to see her with the nerd. They wanted to see her with.
They literally booed.
Who did they want to see her with?
Andrew,
the likable rich kid.
Right, yeah, with Andrew
and
McCarthy.
That's the '80s, right there.
Right, and yet that's what got you in the Brat Pack. Motherfucker, you're in the Brat Pack because you were the cool kid. The nerd didn't get to be in the Brat Pack. And it's true of other people who appear in this film too, right? They're like, I was a Brat Pack adjacent. I wasn't in the actual. And that's really telling because the people who weren't quote unquote in it were a little envious of the people who are in it. But as a result, Cryer's career, I think, has really been accelerated. And the Emilio Estevez excuse about not working with these people is nonsense because John Cryer made his bones. He made more money in his life working with Emilio Estevez's brother, who was also Brat Pack adjacent, on 2.5 Men. I mean, that's where it wasn't about we can't put two Brat Pack actors together because they won't be taken seriously. That's nonsense. That it had to do with the quality of movies you were doing, the roles you were picking. And I think in this case, in McCarthy's case, I do think, and Curtis, you can speak to this as somebody who's been behind the scenes in Hollywood with your good friend Judd Nelson, that when you are a super talented actor and you are making money and being an asshole, people will keep working with you. When you're a super talented actor and you are being an asshole and you are no longer making money for the industry, no one will work with you. And I'm not saying that is true of all people who don't make it in the industry. But there are actors who continue to work even when they're no longer making bank, right? They're not A-listers, but it has to do with them setting their career expectations and getting the kinds of roles that fit who they are now. And a great example of that is another actress who did not appear in this film, but Molly Ringwald has had an amazing second and third act in her career. She has redefined herself, particularly through these amazing TV roles she's doing, like in Feud and so forth. She's emerged as one of the strongest performers of this generation just by working steadily and not drawing that much attention to herself. Well, and by not appearing in this doc, I think it's a strength for her, quite honestly.
We'll get that. And that's a good point. And that's the other thing that occurred to me too, because it's like, if you look at Andrew McCarthy, like, he actually did a lot of movies. He had far more success than so many people could ever want. He made he made good money for a long time. Then he went on and had a career as a travel author. So he had a second career and he was successful in that. They show his place in New York City. It looks like a nice place. He's not, he doesn't look like he's struggling. The idea that it's like, okay, just because you didn't reach this level of success that a Sean Penn or a Tom Cruise did, how many people do, first of all? And you like, how sad that you can't recognize what you did achieve and be happy with that. It's so sad to me that he just can't be like, wow, I did a lot and this was, he just seems so dissatisfied with everything. I'm just like,
well, is it like, why didn't he go talk to Tom and Sean? Like, how come my career didn't turn in as big as yours? But I think, a lot of it, it's the equation. And it's like, if I was one, any of these guys' agents, I'd be like, as soon as they were starting to get pigeonholed and just doing these sort of young people, figuring stuff out and interacting with their friends things. Like I'm sure if you charted it out and like went back in time from, you know, Taps and The Outsiders, that Sean Penn and Tom Cruise agents were like immediately, okay, we got to get you out into like more varied roles. If you think about Andrew McCarthy, like he did a lot of the same kind of person in the same kind of movie. And then you do that enough, then no one's going to see you that way. It's sort of like, you know, as soon as you do a comedy, get into a drama. As soon as you do, you know, do a big period piece, do a small independent, do a wacky comedy. And then, you know, you always kind of change it up so they see that.
And he always wears the same linen blazer. So it's, you know, there's that too.
Yeah, linen blazer, wide eyed, like, Steph.
I think McCarthy, this is the big difference for me. And again, I know he's taken a lot of flack from a lot of people. So I don't want to dish on him too hard.
Sure.
And I have some more things I want to say after this part. But I think it has to do with, if you look at the careers that succeeded, and I'm throwing James Spader in here too. Spader is a key role in so many of these movies, not even mentioned as a Brat Packer. He was adjacent and he was never seen in the mix. Although there is that great sequence of this where he and McCarthy are doing an interview with MTV, I believe. But Spader did this great thing in 1989 where he shifted gears and redefined himself with Sex, Lies, Videotape. He started doing indie movies. And Ally Sheedy, a few years later, shows up in High Art. And suddenly you're like, oh, they took huge pay cuts to be in quality work in indie movies. I think what McCarthy did when he shifted gears, he did Weekend at Bernie's. Mm-hmm. He did some comedies. But I think he saw those movies as below him. And I'm only going to say that insofar as there are some actors who don't embrace the comedy and they see it as being below them. And I think he took the money and did the paycheck and did the sequel. And then I don't get the sense he's proud of those movies in a way that he maybe could and should be.
Right.
And I'm not saying that ironically. Rob Lowe, the reason Rob Lowe is successful today is because he did Tommy Boy. The second he did Tommy Boy and was willing to be a goofy villain,
that's a pivot point for him,
himself in that movie, it opened up his career. And then the other thing he did and the thing John Cryer did and the thing Charlie Sheen did, and for fuck's sake, the thing Martin Sheen did, their father, they all were willing to work in television before working in television was cool. Like right now, everybody works in television. Everybody does series.
Yeah, but it used to not be that way.
Yeah, there was a line, and I guarantee you, I would be willing to look back at Andrew McCarthy's career and say, how many TV roles did you turn down? Because that was where your quality work was going to be, in the window where you were going to be most productive in your 30s.
Well, it was risky back. Yeah, it was risky. Like, you're exactly right, because it's like, oh, if I start doing TV, they're going to think of me, you know, because like a lot, like Tom
Cruise.
There
was
Cruise
a line.
And, like,
you were TV actor. Yeah. You were TV. Now you're TV. That's it.
Because I was going to do soap operas when I started out, and I even remember being like, I don't want to be on a soap opera, but like, that's a great place, you know, to jump out from. But then again, like a lot of the soap opera actors I got to know, they got there and they stayed there and never got out.
Yeah.
You know, Demi Moore was on a soap opera, but like, get the hell out as soon as you can.
Right. Well, once you go up, right, you graduate from TV to film, but once you're in film, you don't go back to TV. And that's changed so dramatically.
But like something like West Wing stands, you know, as an awesome piece of work compared to any other movie, TV show or painting or whatever, you know, like nowadays, like, you know,
right,
like,
but the actors who did that then—that was bold. That was a big—that was a big risk, and they did it. Andrew McCarthy in this window seems to be saying, oh, "Isn't it such a shame we were in the Brat Pack?" I mean, and then, but he's
over
the one
and
doing
over
it, like,
and over and over again.
He's literally talking to the person at the hot dog stand, being like, do you know anybody in the Brat Pack? Do you recognize? You happen to recognize? Like, is there any Brat Pack actors ever come here to buy hot dogs? Like in the last like maybe 3 minutes? Like
wink, wink.
It's like that sketch on Saturday Night Live where she say, "Don't make me sing." Like, don't make me sing. Don't make me sing. Like, he's saying, "I don't want to be part of the Brat Pack." But what's interesting about the way this film works, and I think this is relevant to something we can talk about our own personal lives. So you brought up earlier, Curtis, how there's some actors who don't appear in this movie. Some he wanted. He wanted Judd. He wanted Molly Ringwald. And there's a whole running thread in the movie how they're either not returning his calls. And maybe at the very end, it's Judd Nelson on the phone. But Sean Penn and Tom Cruise aren't mentioned. And you're like, well, how come he didn't call them? I was like, he doesn't have their number. I mean, I'm just saying they're not returning his calls.
Well,
so what's most interesting to me about this film, and I'm going to review this part with more sympathy and grace, is I view this very much as Andrew McCarthy reuniting with his old friends, kind of lamenting A, that he didn't celebrate the Brat Pack when he was in it. So even though he's using the premise as it sucked to be in the Brat Pack, didn't it? Come on, guys. Didn't it kind of suck? When Rob Lowe starts talking about, like, yeah, and then we went to Sammy Davis Jr.'s house. He's like, yeah, that was fucking awesome. I think he's lamenting that. And so no secret here. We all just went to one of our high school reunions.
Right.
And there's something amazing about reconnecting with people you haven't seen in 30 years.
Yeah.
And so I watched this through the lens that we just lived through, which is, this is his high school reunion. He didn't have the experience most of us have had. Right. And him getting to sit with Demi Moore and reconnect with Rob Lowe and go to the house of John Cryer and so forth. That's
and hang out with one of his favorite seniors, Timothy Hutton, you know.
Yeah, he got to Timothy
the Hutton. The godfather of the Brat Pack.
He's the ultimate beekeeper. Apparently, Jason Statham might work under a secret society for him and kick people's
asses. But if there had been somebody at the reunion who had just sat there and just went on and on about how, like, you know, all the things they didn't like about high school, how long would you have wanted to sat there and talk to them? Not very long.
Right, exactly. Except the premise is he has to frame it that way to get them into the conversation. Yeah. So he's working
Molly,
through this thing. Yeah,
I'm out.
Well, that's right. Well, there are people who didn't show up to our reunion.
Well,
right?
At high school reunion, like I had this experience at my college reunion where like these two girls I went to school with like rehashed and got into some stuff that went down like, you know, 30 years ago. Like, and it was like,
kind of fun.
How can you turn me down for that sorority? I didn't think you fit in at the time, you know. So they had it out, but you know,
did earrings get removed? Did they take out earrings?
I thought that was kind of rare. I mean, like at our high school reunion where people like, you know, that. You talk about memories and stuff versus like work through some shit that went on, you know.
What I loved about the film, and again, I've heard people really trash this movie. And
I didn't hate it.
There's two ways to approach it, right? You can approach the documentary as it's a shit film, or you can say it's so ripe with things to talk about that I have to watch the whole thing. I've had a number of conversations with people who said I couldn't finish it. Like I couldn't finish this.
Well, I think nobody got nobody got what they expected, which they thought was going to be a big, huge, like everyone together. And they're having great times and laughs and talking about all these things that happened. But majority of it was clips of the old movies and yakety yak.
There's some moments though that I really like. Right. I love the moment when he's talking to Ally Sheedy and they're talking about just driving in this Jeep and being driven home. And I remember moments like that where you just had this, just moment with a person and it stays with you your whole life.
Totally.
And nothing romantic might have happened or whatever, but you just knew in that moment it just felt like life's possibilities were limitless. And so he's trying to recapture that in this film. And so to me, there's something very longing about it because he framed it with this sort of discontent around being in the Brat Pack. But the truth is, you can tell he loves it. It's a lovely thing. And I think he regrets, to me, the sense is he regrets not enjoying it when it was happening because now he's trying to recapture it. And it's ephemeral. He can't grab it. He has these moments with the people.
Well,
this is his attempt to at least have a platform to.
Despite what he says, I think the jury was out on whether it really helped or hurt him, to be honest. Like, how could you know? Well, but
Aaron is the only one of us who's actually read the full article. I've browsed it and I read, as I said, the Thomas Goga article in which he read it and processed it for me. The article.
It's a short.
Was a article, but the headline was what lasted. And so the headline, and Malcolm Gladwell, again, my other secret boyfriend, Malcolm Gladwell he's his assessment of this, like he tells Andrew McCarthy right to his face. He's like, it's funny. I don't understand why you don't get this. And Andrew McCarthy's don't you see how it hurt? And he's like, no, this is great.
Right.
You're part of this thing. And then the great moment comes when he admits, I wanted to be Ducky. I thought Ducky was the coolest kid in school. I'm like, of course you did, Malcolm Gladwell. That's why I'm Ducky in the fucking thing too. Like, we get it.
Yeah.
And he didn't get the girl. Like, he's not cool enough to be in the Brat Pack, but he aspires to be in the Brat Pack. Dude, you were in it. You didn't even realize how good you had it.
The other thing I noticed too. He talks about that though, and he talks about people just come up to me and they'll be like, I was Team Ducky, and he's so offended by that. I'm like, They were characters, dude. Like, are you really taking this personally? Like, I would be like, why can't you see it? Like, oh, it's cool that you're invested. It's cool that you're picking a team. It's cool. Like, you really see that as some sort of personal affront that they weren't Team Blaine? Like, it's just, he's so weird. I don't know. You're giving him a lot of credit, Gabe. I take it for face value. For me, if he didn't sit right there and say these things right up front, then I don't know if he's really feeling it. If I don't know if he's really... I don't know, this whole nostalgia, I feel like he just wanted to whine a lot.
But we were feeling it. The audience inserts the nostalgia, whether he's feeling it or not. But I don't know.
He wasn't satisfying it enough. And that's probably why a lot of people, Gabe was saying, couldn't watch it.
Well, it's like he's looking for something about it, but it's like he's figuring it out as he goes along. Because it's all just a wondering thing. It's not like he was wandering around like, damn this article. But like,
really? I thought it was.
I mean, yes and no. I felt like, you know, the premise was like, you know, this article screwed me up and maybe everyone else too. But like when he goes to interview Bloom, right, the guy that wrote the article, and you're and especially when they showed like in the, you know, Today interview and when they showed like him back in the 80s, I immediately thought of, you know, despite what the guy was saying, and it wasn't intentionally trying to slam them or anything like that, you immediately thought like, okay, here's the guy that, and you this is kind of like Hollywood and politics world, that a lot of people involved in a way to kind of get back at the kids in high school that they weren't in the in crowd or something like that, you know what I mean?
Right.
So like this Bloom guy, like you just imagine him in high school, you know, he probably like got off on like slamming these pretty people in Hollywood a bit too. Like that's kind of my vibe.
So I think there's a lot in this film about who's included and who's not. There's this idea of gatekeeping. Mm-hmm. And so the guy who wrote the article, you had hit on this, Curtis, that he felt left out too. As somebody who has written some cultural criticism and interviewed people, you always have to recognize that when you write an article like David Blum did about this group of Hollywood stars, he's a 29-year-old New York intellectual. Right, he works for New Yorker magazine or New York magazine, and he's out in Hollywood being surrounded by kids who seem to have it all. They're in a high cultural moment. They're surrounded by champagne and cocaine and beautiful women and and so it makes sense that he's going to have a sense of jealousy and envy. Yeah. He did not embed himself the way some others, like we talked about Cameron Crowe in the Fast Times episode. He doesn't embed himself. And I think Emilio's mistake was treating him like a friend or a peer when he's a journalist. And when the journalist writes, and it's not malicious, but every journalist is writing from a perspective, any point of view. And this is before social media. However, it is still true that when you write an article like this, contrast and controversy is going to get a higher result than a very anodyne, hey, these kids are really well behaved and they're super talented. You should go see these movies. That's a boring story.
That would have been a pup story piece. You're right.
They're brats and they're outrageous and they party a lot and they're having too much fun. Look at me. I'm in New York living in an apartment the size of an RV, and these guys have palatial estates and they're eating out at Spago every night. So there is that piece to it. McCarthy, interestingly, is an outsider in the article. Blum recognizes that he's the New Yorker in the group. He sees the kid from New York, and he's a drive-by. McCarthy is literally a drive-by in the article. He's mentioned one time.
True.
And so it's interesting, even amongst the Brat Packers, they see McCarthy a little bit as an outsider. And it's interesting that he is so hell-bent on embedding himself in that group and defining himself with them when Leah Thompson and John Cryer are outside the group, and they seem to aspire to be in it because they saw value and it was part of the cool kids. So that inside outside thing is very important. And this is where what Gladwell hits on, Gladwell being biracial. And there's one other cultural critic in the piece named Ira Madison, a African-American writer. And both of them point out very patently and blatantly the thing that is obvious to anybody watching the John Hughes movies and so forth is, where's the people of color at? Like, it's all white people in these movies. And when they do appear, it's usually not very favorable. See Long Duck Dong. And it's very white, privilegey, in and of itself. So the angsty piece of it is built into the formula of what they were making. Right. And yet they're like, oh, poor me, poor me. It does feel a little indulgent. So that part I completely get. Widen your lens a little bit and seeing outside of your own myopic view of the tragedy of your life would show you how not really tragic this story is.
Well, I enjoyed it, but like definitely as a out of work actor, you know, and doing the Hollywood thing and struggling, you know, there's a part of me that is like, oh, boo, frickety, who for right. you? You had a, right. you know, you got cast in something and then you got some more jobs after it. Like,
right.
you would all kill right. for that. Like, oh, great. You know, I'm playing like guy in an off at a desk in a commercial. Like, I'm excited about that. Like, it was interesting and fascinating to sit and ride along with Andrew McCarthy. But yeah, like part of me is like, I don't really feel bad for you, man. Sorry.
Well, I'll say this is we will talk about some of his other movies and specifically the kinds of roles he plays. I think Andrew McCarthy is a very smart and introspective person. I do mm-hmm. think he had the blind spot of his own missing out on the joy that was present there.
Well, I think he admits that.
I do think it's in this movie, and I think him mm-hmm. revisiting some of it. I wonder, because the more interesting thing about the film as a cinematic piece, and I give him a lot of credit as a director, is the archival footage in it is great. So I wonder if, because we don't get to see any of him in the editing room or that process, that part to me would also be very cathartic. I can say this as somebody, again, we just went to a reunion, looking at old pictures, revisiting old things. Curtis, you had the video yearbook you just reviewed. Like seeing artifacts of your life at that time is also, it takes you back a moment. And while nostalgia is a toxic impulse, it is also something that we can brush with from time to time and do feel the spirit of youth. As you age, you want to recapture that sense of possibility. And I feel like this film is trying to do that. I do think that's part of his quest. I want to be very aware. So we're going to have our very meta moment here. This podcast itself is partly an exercise. It's very similar to what Andrew McCarthy is doing in Bratz. Mm-hmm. We're three friends from high school.
Really?
We're rewatching the films from that era. We're talking about them. So A2 Brute, like we're doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying hanging out with you guys. I'm enjoying having these conversations. And I really want to tell our listener, well, okay, let's hope there's more than one. Our listener. That thanks for coming along with us too. We appreciate y'all being here and being part of this experience. We're tapping into something that we know is happening in our lives and we're trying to share it with everybody else. So
thank you, Bubba, for listening.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for listening, guys.
Okay, I do want to read this one thing from the article. Like, I do want to read this one thing from the article because I think it's okay. And it says, it says, and of Andrew McCarthy, one of the New York-based actors in St. Elmo's Fire, a co-star says, he plays, and this is quote, he plays all his roles with too much of the same intensity. I don't think he'll make it, end quote. And it doesn't name the co-star.
Oh,
you guys think it is?
It's Judd Nelson.
Maybe that's what that was the secret.
Or Rob
the
Lowe.
Secret quest of the documentary to find out who said that in the article. Who do you think it was?
It was the St. Elmo's Fire co-star. So it was either Lowe or Nelson.
Maybe that's why Judd was avoiding.
Maybe that's why. Maybe it was Judd. You think it was Judd?
Judd thought he was trying to get him on the record. Like, you said that, didn't you, motherfucker? You sunk my career. Just an opinion.
Yeah, Judd didn't strike me as having much of a filter, so I'm sure there was none. I don't know. Well, you know.
Yeah,
more,
I think
they didn't really show much of him, like, in the interview footage in the past either and stuff, so I'm sort of curious about that. And it's like almost like the way it ended where it's like, Judd? Was that stage
I
or what?
I did love
it's
that
like,
ending, though.
Yeah,
it was. But it makes me think, is there going to be a part two where he ends up, you know, face to face with Judd and Molly and
we're already setting up Bratz.
Sean Penn and Timothy Hutton and busting to save the day.
So I think this opens us up for transitioning out to our outro segment for this, because the movie, it does end on that kind of perfect moment. It ends on, picks up the phone, says Judd, and then here comes Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me, which is the song of this era. So normally we end our segment with a rating of the movie, and then we talk about what we're picking next week. But as a bonus episode, we're going to end this one with just a special piece of bonus content we're going to create on the air so y'all can hear us talk through how we're going to make a mixtape. So after the upcoming break, we're going to make our own mixtape. The one premise is going to be there's going to be 10 songs. There's three of us, so we each pick three songs, and the 10th song is going to be Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me. So that's built into the formula, and we'll come out of the break, and each of us is going to have a couple songs from that generation ready
for
to go. Make a live mixtape on the air.
We'll be back.
Hello again, Gen Xers. It's me, Curtis, and I'm back. Before we build this awesome mixtape, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening. You're the reason I keep recording this crazy little podcast. And I wanted to remind you to stay connected on the social channels at Rated Gen X Pod in the coming weeks, because we'll soon be sharing details about subscription options and member benefits. Imagine creating your own very Gen X Pod mixtape for our channel. How cool would that be? There's more to come, and we can't wait to take this to the next level. Thanks again for your support. Now, let's get ready to mix that tape.
All right. So we're back. I am super excited to record a mixtape about this movie in particular. I'm so excited to record this. And for those who remember, the way you make your mixtape is you have your boombox going, you have your record and play button on, and you have the pause. And then when the song comes on the radio that you want to hear, you got to lift it real fast and get it going.
Oh, yeah.
So, Aaron, you do get to pick the first song. And let's all remember, Don't You Forget About Me will be the last one on the list.
Okay. All right. I'm going to pick one that I I've always loved, but I think was underrated and has never been in a movie. And it's from 1983, and it's In a Big Country by the Scottish band Big Country,
which is one of those songs that has the name of the band in the
song. And I love that song. And it's a great song, and it's just it's underrated, and somebody needs to put it. Someone should.
Well, those opening chords and everything. Yeah, or just very like bring you right back to that era too.
Just yeah, maybe it's my Scottish heritage. It just
I like that.
Anyway, so that's my first choice
in a big country.
Right. First choice.
Right. Okay, Curtis, what do you got?
Are you writing this down? Who's writing this? Yes. Who's secretary?
Yeah, we're writing it.
Okay. Okay. I guess we're recording it too.
The first one that popped into my head was "Wouldn't It Be Good." Well, the song "Wouldn't It Be Good." I mean, I remember that from Pretty in Pink, and it sort of goes with that whole. You know, I think there's like a teen thing where everyone always thinks the other person's in a better situation. You know, the grass is always greener kind of thing. You know, wouldn't it be good to be in your shoes, and even if it was for just one day? I think with a lot of the music then, like to me, it wasn't necessarily the words either. It was just sort of the emotion from the musicality of it just as much as like the subject matter of the song. But, you know, everyone's always thinking that they suck when the person watching them walk by thinks they're the shit, and, you know, everyone's thinking the other person's in a better situation. I wish I had, you know, what they had or where they were or whatever. I mean, I think I probably played that song at parties in college too. And everyone's like, why are you playing that? I'm like, fuck you. It's my party. You know,
and I'll cry if I want to.
And I'll play
Speaking of which, I'm going to go with another title. That is a question. I think questions are a great, great way to define Gen X on the dance floor. And I would be remiss if I didn't start with the what I would consider the Gen X anthem, and probably the song that's the spiritual leader of this Andrew McCarthy film, which is The Smiths' "How Soon Is Now." I literally, when I hear Morrissey say, "I'm human and I need to be loved just like everybody else does," that's literally Andrew McCarthy calling. Hey, Demi, will you do this documentary with me? Hey, Judd, hey, Timothy Hutton, what's going on, man? I'd love to see you. This is him reaching out to those people, and it's him saying, like, now can we be happy? Like, now can we do it? And so as this is a song that has aged remarkably well, too, because
Yeah.
It does that thing we talk about, which is you remember being the awkward 14, 15, 16 year old on the dance floor feeling like a wallflower and going home alone. But now you're looking back on that and you're like reconnecting with those people. And there is something really, really nice about it. So when you look back at this part, he's the sun and the air of something of shyness that's criminally vulgar. And yet now you can see it as the point of view of somebody who's made it through that, look back on it. So the Smiths, How Soon Is Now. And every high school dance we went to, that yeah. song would play. I have no idea, because if you put that song on the dance floor now, like, you're clearing the place out. People are like, this is a 7-minute song with a droning beat. But for some reason at the time, that was the jam at every single dance we had. So it is the theme song of our generation. So I'm putting it right.
That's the only Smith song that I actually really like, and don't, because I privately like make fun of his voice. It's da 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 da. But I,
right,
I do.
Curtis, this is, yeah, I'm going to cut you out from here on. You're no longer part of the show. So goodbye. I'm disowning you.
I like to watch.
All right, Aaron, what do you got?
These guys were never in movies enough. But again, they kind of did their own movies. Their music videos were movies in and of themselves. Curtis, I think you might know where I'm going with this. I'm going to pick a Duran Duran song. Yeah. Mm. All right. I mean, Duran Duran. I mean, you cannot have okay. so, and they really aren't in any other than, you know, they did A View to Kill, like that was in '80s, but I mean, they aren't in any soundtracks. They kind of, they aren't a soundtrack, but, and which one am I going to do? Oh gosh, so many. I think I'm going to do Girls on Film. Cause you know, it's apropos. I'm going to do that one. I just think it's a sexy song. I love that song. And I just feel like they never got soundtrack recognition.
I almost want to say, strangely, they might have been too popular. Like, a lot of the music that did make it, particularly in the U.S., it was the right. Brit pop new wave music. But I think Duran Duran had crossed over so much that they would have stood out. Like, I don't want to call them the Beatles of that generation, but you'd hear them everywhere, and it might have taken you out of the movie in a way that some
That's
of these
true.
Sort of more deep cut type songs maybe carried the vibe a little more. I think they were seen
That's
as a little
true.
Too popular.
Hmm.
It is so Who's interesting. Next? So it's just a side note. I am looking up some of their movie soundtrack appearances. And they did appear, but they appear in a lot of sort of bigger Hollywood movies that we wouldn't consider period-specific generational movies. So an example of that time, like Hot Dog the movie, right, was comedy movie about skiing, as I recall. But that had Hungry Like a Wolf in it.
I do remember that now, oddly. I don't remember much, but for some reason I remember that.
Right, but it wouldn't be in a John Hughes movie. It would only be in like a big Hollywood-y style movie instead, because that's how big they were. They weren't John Hughes cool. They were teen comedy cool.
Right.
So, all right, Curtis, what's your second choice?
The whole, you know, you talked about the San Elmo's fire theme, I think. I'm sorry. You know, the I'm a Man in Motion. Not that song. The music, I don't know if it's the love theme or whatever. They talked about it in Bratz, I think, where they were doing the video.
Oh, really?
That.
I don't know.
Yeah, the love theme. Well, they did Man in Motion, but the love theme also was a big hit song.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's instrumental, but it kind of makes me think of high school graduation. And, you know, when I watch San Elmo's Fire, like, oh, it's just like my friends in college or whatever. But, like, in terms of the Brat Pack era, like, that music is definitely a big hook into me from that era. And that's all I have to say about that.
Well, that's an interesting choice.
Right. I'm going to jump in with another banger. And this is another dance floor hit iconic song of our generation. So I'm going with New Order's Bizarre Love Triangle, which, again, the driving beat of that song. And that song does end up in a lot of movies because every
Pretty in Pink, isn't it?
Sequence needs it. Yeah, it's brilliant. So, and it's an amazing song. The more I listen to it, the better it gets. I love that one. I love Blue Monday, which was I was fighting between the two, but I felt like Bizarre Love Triangle was more appropriate for our podcast just because we got three of us and we're in our own little Bizarre Love Triangle. We have a love-hate relationship going on. So that would be the subtitle of our podcast. It would be Rated
Bizarre
Gen
Love
X.
Triangle.
Yeah, Bizarre Love Triangle.
Our Bizarre Love Triangle.
Maybe let's call this bonus episode Bratz: Bizarre Love Triangle.
sorry, that's fine.
Oh, good God. Anyway.
Less than zero. Life imitates art, imitates life.
All right. Who's next? Am I next?
You're next.
Is
you're
it back to me?
You're back to
see, I'm going to so my direction is so different from you guys because I'm going with, it's like my theme is like things that like these should have been and weren't. And although this one I feel like is in a movie one, I think like it is. But I had two choices here and I went back and forth. And went back
I know what you're going to say.
But
I know what you're going to say.
No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't.
All right. Write it down, Curtis.
Do you want to pass?
Write it on a sheet of paper.
Write it down.
Write it on a sheet of paper and hold it up.
Because I bet you don't. You have no idea.
And
you have no freaking idea.
Any listener also, if you're ready to guess.
Tell me when you're ready.
Don't write it. Don't write it. No, you don't show it. That's not how the game works. Curtis literally just did. You just did Newlywed Game by showing your partner what their answer should be. That's not how Newlywed Game works. This bizarre love triangle is over.
I didn't see it. I know, right? Curtis, my God. Anyway,
I'm going to this side of the counter. It's time to break up.
I know, right?
Yeah, Amelia, we're cutting you off now, Amelia.
When I pull out the hot pocket, it means it's over.
Okay. It's Boy George Culture Club. Do you really want to hurt me?
Perfect. Another question.
Oh, that wasn't it, was it, Curtis? I can tell by the look on your face.
Yet another question title.
I can tell.
I think question titles are the under theme of our thing, too. Do you really want to hurt me?
Do you really want to hurt me?
What was your guess, Curtis? Let's see what your guess was, though.
Well, Curtis' guess is probably going to be his pick now. So, Curtis, you might have backed yourself into this one.
Yeah.
Do you really want to? Oh,
I thought you were going to say this. Is there anything on there?
Actually, I can't even read that.
Is it backwards?
Running up that hill. That's such because that's like getting all kinds of because of Stranger Things.
Yeah. I don't give a shit. I was there listening to it before Stranger Things.
Yeah, but you know, I like to pick
and Stranger Things is an 80s thing.
I'm giving recognition to things that aren't getting recognition.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Point.
You can do that. That's your choice. Right.
I'm just pulling out.
I'm going to order off the other
menu.
You
went awry in your guess. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Curtis is ordering off menu.
Can I stick with it or you want me to go off?
You stick with it. Go for it.
No, go with what you want to
Kate Bush running up that hill, regardless of the overplay and the resurgence of it. It's one of those things that to me like hooks me into that time. Because you know, that's the whole thing with music. It's also nostalgic but also inspirational. For now, but that ties into my whole Brat Packy, that era of that song for me.
I love, I mean, a big fan of Stranger Things, and I love the fact that the song has actually come back. And Kate Bush has more currency now. She's probably made more money off of those 0.5 cent downloads.
That was the thing, because you know how like sometimes you wonder, like, is everyone getting this song or saw that thing in the horror movie the same way I did or have that feeling about that song? So I didn't realize it was like, you know, on everyone's consciousness too as much, because obviously Stranger Things picked that song for various reasons, but like, and like Kate Bush, like, you know, cha-ching, millions of dollars more from that song being played and used again and all that stuff. But, you know,
all right, Curtis, your song pick inspired one for me because I had a couple of that era, but one that yours inspired, quite honestly, and I think it fits this theme perfectly, is The Motels' Suddenly Last Summer.
Mm.
And
that is a film,
that
is a song that is very cinematic. Every time I hear it,
it
expresses, it's very visual to me.
It's like the atmosphere of the song is key.
Yeah.
It's so great. And so I'm just like, there's this great review of the song. It says, "Suddenly last summer percolated for years. The song written after Martha Davis's parents died, her mom by suicide and her dad from illness, is a reflection on the moments of life when things are changing, like when it's a beautiful sunny day and a cold wind blows and you know the end of summer is coming." And there's something about that. Again, it feels very much like the perfect way to tie in the whole conversation about lost youth and nostalgia and looking back fondly, but also thinking about things in terms of what's going to be ahead as well. And so I think Suddenly Last Summer is a nice song to end our portion of this. And then we're going to go right into the Simple Minds finale. Mm. Don't You Forget About Me? Mm-hmm. Question mark? No.
Don't You Forget About Me?
No. I like, if we really wanted to be a Gen X song. But there is something about, like, Don't You Forget About Me as a song. So interestingly, again, in when it came out, it's a song that is saying don't forget about me, and it resonates more at the end of Bratz, quite honestly, than it does at the end of Breakfast Club, because now he's saying, no, really, I'm at the hot dog stand. These people don't fucking know who I am. Don't forget about me. Like, it's like a rallying call now for Andrew McCarthy. So I want to give this film the love it deserves. I super appreciate what McCarthy has done in making it. I'm so happy he made it. And I'm actually really glad that we had this chance to talk about it, because we're going to talk about some of his other movies, and we're going to talk about movies of this generation. So this was kind of perfect timing for us. So how do y'all feel? We did our first bonus episode.
Yeah, it was fun.
You forget about me. Yeah. I'll be alone dancing. You know it. You know it, baby. Okay.
Aaron, you can cut anytime you want. This.
Yeah, I will. I think so. I think it's time.
Oh, I thought you cut. I was just going to.
No, I didn't.
This Rated Gen X bonus episode was written, performed, and produced by Gabe Wardell, Aaron O'Reilly, and Curtis Eames. Post-production by Gabe Wardell. Theme music by Ryan Thomas Johnson. Don't you forget about us on the socials. We're at Rated Gen X Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Email us at hello@ratedgenxpod.com. To listen to the mixtape Curtis, Aaron, and Gabe just created live in this episode, visit the show notes on ratedgenxpod.com or find the link to our mixtape on Instagram. Thank you for listening to this bonus episode of Rated Gen X. And now, back to your regular podcast feed.
This is a bonus episode, man.
It's a bonus. It might go
plus, we have a lot we're cutting out. So let's we'll record and cut.
Let it all hang out.
That's how we're going to cut that out. I'm cutting that out. It's just nonsense.